to Global Crossings, a podcast produced by the Global Leadership Institute at Boston College. Ken McIntosh, MSP, the presiding officer, speaker of the Scottish Parliament, discusses Scotland's relationship with the United Kingdom, European Union, and the United States. Ken addresses the evolution of the Scottish Parliament, Brexit, calls for a second independence referendum, and other important issues of devolved government in the United Kingdom. Moderated by Dr. Robert Morrow, Director of the Global Leadership Institute at Boston College, with opening remarks by Ellen Wong, Principal Officer of the United States Consulate General in Edinburgh, Scotland, United Kingdom. Enjoy the podcast, adapted from a previously recorded webinar on Wednesday, February 12, 2021.
This afternoon's session, I'm really excited about this. This has been delayed at this point now about a year. Today's session is Scotland, United Kingdom, and Europe. What's next? We have the presiding officer, Ken McIntosh, member for Scottish Parliament, joining us to talk about Scotland in the United Kingdom and Europe. And as I said, this was supposed to be an in-person event last April, and I think we had decided to push it off to October at the beginning of the pandemic before we realized what that might mean. And here we are in a digital platform, but we do hope to welcome the presiding officer to Boston College in the near future. So, hopefully as this pandemic winds down in the coming year. So I won't make any promises though. But before we have Ken McIntosh, the presiding officer, joining us, it's my pleasure to welcome Ellen Wong, the principal officer from the U.S. Consulate in Edinburgh. Ellen previously was deputy political and economic counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Dakar and in Bangladesh, and she's former senior country officer for Germany. Between 2010 and 2015, Ellen served in Beijing as special assistant for East Asia and Pacific in the Office of the Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. So Ellen joins this session and her role in Edinburgh with quite a lot of global experience. Ellen, thank you for joining us today. If you have a moment to say a few words of welcome and to talk a little bit about your work in Scotland, it'll be great to hear.
That would be great. Thanks so much, Bob. And thanks so much to Boston College and the Scottish Parliament for inviting me to join you today for what I know will be a very interesting discussion in particularly interesting times. As Bob said, my name is Ellen Wong. I've been the principal officer here at the U.S. Consulate General in Edinburgh since October 2018. And I'm a career foreign service officer, so which is why I've served U.S. government around the world previously. The Scottish Parliament really has been an excellent partner for the U.S. Consulate General in Edinburgh since the Scottish Parliament was established just over 20 years ago. Meanwhile, we've had a US consulate in Edinburgh in Scotland since 1798. So it's one of our oldest relationships. The formal cooperation between the US consulate and Scottish Parliament deepened 2 years ago with the establishment of the first cross-party group on the United States, which has served as an excellent forum to bring together members of Scottish Parliament, also called MSPs, and groups and individuals in Scotland that represent the economic, educational, cultural links between the United States and Scotland. And what I've learned during my time here in Scotland, representing the United States, is that there's really such an impressive range of US-Scotland ties that have existed since before the founding of the United States, largely from the many immigrants that came from Scotland to the United States, but also that this relationship continues to grow in scope and in depth. Just yesterday, I spoke at a virtual trade mission for dozens of Scottish businesses looking to join their compatriots as exporters into or investors in the US market. It's great to see so much interest, even when travel and meetings aren't possible, and gives me a lot of hope about the economic recovery in both our countries. And while political and economic ties are undoubtedly important and often grab the headlines, it's really the people-to-people ties that make the US-UK and US-Scotland relationship so strong. And we know that the young people are the future of that relationship, which is why we're so thrilled to see so many Americans studying at Scottish universities and Scots studying at American universities, as well as events like these that bring together people from both sides of the Atlantic to increase mutual understanding. The networks and affinity developed from such exchanges can only strengthen the alliance between our countries that President Biden has said are America's greatest assets. And that's why I'm especially pleased that you'll be hearing from Presiding Officer Ken McIntosh today, who has been such an advocate for the US-Scotland relationship and a great partner to the consulate. And I'll just add that the Scottish Parliament even welcomes interns from the United States every year, although this may not have happened in the past year, but this may be an opportunity for some of the people tuning in today. So thank you all for becoming part of the fabric of the US-Scotland relationship. And I hope you enjoy the talk and that you'll have the opportunity to actually come in person to Scotland when the pandemic is over. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. I really appreciate that. It's great to get your insights on the US-Scottish relationship and to have your support for this. In the past, we've taken students from Boston College to Scotland, and it's always good to have an official relationship with the consulate to support that. So thank you very much. It's my pleasure now to welcome Ken McIntosh, the presiding officer for the Scottish Parliament. Before I give him a brief introduction, and it'll be a very brief one, I'll allow the presiding officer to introduce himself. I'd like to remind everyone, and I haven't always done this so early in the session, that there is a Q&A function where you can ask questions. You can also ask questions through the chat function. I'll try to get to as many questions as I possibly can and convey them kind of accurately to the presiding officer. But please do reach out at any point with questions. Ken McIntosh was originally a television producer, and some of the programs you worked on were BBC News, Breakfast with Frost. If everyone has seen the movie Frost Nixon, that's the same David Frost. You were elected in 1999 as a Labour MSP, and you served until about 2002. You lost your seat, and then you returned in 2007. In 2016, you returned as an MSP for a new constituency, the West of Scotland, and took up the role of presiding officer. And so, you know, presiding officer, I'd like to start with that journey into politics and what took you away from producing, current affairs news programs to representing a constituency in Scotland.
Thanks very much, Bob. And before I start as well, can I just say thanks very much for creating this opportunity. I'm so sorry we're not there in person to have this interchange. Hopefully the pandemic will allow perhaps my successor to come and speak to you at Boston in the immediate future. I can also just say thanks to Ellen. I just repeat Ellen's remarks. We have a very close relationship with Ellen and the American consulate here, a very helpful one. We do have a lot of interns. I've had a number of American interns myself in my own office. I'm particularly a USophile. I've got, I should just say, I've got six kids. Two of them are currently studying in America, and the third is about to go to, he's just been admitted to Tufts, just down the road from you, starting in August. So I'll be coming to Boston soon, no matter what. So yeah, just to go back to my own political career, I was a television producer for the first 13 years, for 13 years with the BBC. But I'd always believed in devolution in the Scottish Parliament. My father had been a campaigner for devolution. We'd had an unsuccessful campaign for devolution back in the late 70s. And I'd always thought that Scotland, the relationship between Scotland and the rest of the United Kingdom would have been served better by our own Scottish Parliament, because we are a separate country. We're part of a United Kingdom, but we're a separate country. And I always supported that. But what actually got me into, that's what made me stand for Parliament. But what got me into politics in the first place was when I was I'm not sure how old your participants are, but when I was a student at university, around the age of 18, 19, 20, it was a particularly, so this was in the late 70s, early 80s, it was a particularly difficult time, both with industrial and social discontent, moving from heavy industry, big steel plants and coal mining and car manufacturing to a more modern economy. And it was a time of great social disruption. And I joined the Labour Party at that point as my demonstration of my commitment to doing something about it, but with no intention of pursuing a political career of any kind whatsoever. Just, I thought, well, I've got to do something. So I joined the Labour Party. And it was the Scottish Parliament, which then made me put my name forward because I'd always believed in devolution. So it was sort of two strands, the political and the other one, which is more parliamentary, which is the believer in an institution that could serve Scotland. And I politics is not a, we always talk about it as a, it's not a career at all. It's a public office, which you're very fortunate if you're lucky to hold. And if you're even more fortunate, you get re-elected. And so in my case, I thought I was in a quite a tricky seat. I didn't think I would get re-elected, but I actually was re-elected successfully 22 years now. So it's turned into a career, not a planned one, but it turned into a career.
Why did you make that jump? I mean, you're committed to the labor movement. You're committed to devolution, so representing labor and industry in Scotland and for Scotland. But you made this move to the presiding officer. I mean, maybe first you can explain what the presiding officer is. We lack really a composite kind of feature here in U.S. politics. And then why did you make that move?
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I should have explained that. The presiding officer is the speaker. So Nancy Pelosi in the Senate, I believe, is she the speaker? No, I just don't remember now.
Yeah, the speaker.
And Lindsay Hoyle in Westminster. And so the speaker is the chair of the proceedings and is the parliamentary representative, the person who represents the parliament, both at home and abroad. And I also chair the key committees in Parliament. So I chair the committee that runs the building, the facilities. I also chair the committee that makes the political decisions about what to discuss and debate. So we have a neutral chair. So the presiding officer in the context of the United Kingdom tradition in the Scottish Parliament and Westminster is neutral. So I was a Labour politician, but when you decide to go for the position of speaker, you have to leave your political party and you have to become impartial. Now, I'll be honest with you, nobody goes into politics to become the presiding officer. You know, you go into politics to make a difference, to change things, to make the world a better place. Whether you're on the right, the left, or whatever, you know, we're all trying to improve the world and improve public services and make people's lives better. And, you know, we've got different views about how to do that. When you go for the speaker's job, it's a different stage. What you're doing then is you are taking on a role, the function of which is to make sure that everybody else has a fair platform on which to speak. So my job is to make sure that everybody has the chance to make their views known. And it's a neutral role. I'm also there to defend the parliament. So in my case, there's a couple of reasons that I applied for it. I'd been an MSP since 99, so for 17 years as a Labour member. I'll be honest, I stood twice to be Labour leader, and I lost both times. So, and I'd lost in 20, just before I was the election 2016, I'd lost just before that. And then at that election, I moved from constituency to the list. So it was one of these stages where I was trying to work out what my role would be. I had a new leader who defeated me in the election. Labour itself wasn't doing very well, I'll be honest with you as well, although that's neither here nor there, that's just another factor to take into account. But the thing for me, the most important thing was that I'd entered politics because I believe in the Scottish Parliament, and I was slightly worried that the Parliament had not lost sight of its original principles, but drifted away from it. You know, we came in as we're an old democracy, but with a new institution. And I was slightly worried that what we were promising, a new openness about politics, a new cross, a more consensual way of doing business, a proportionate voting system, for example, as opposed to the majoritarian system at Westminster. A lot of that early promise, I was worried that it was going to be lost, and I didn't want to, and I was very much a champion of that new way of doing politics. So I put my name forward and I was successful. So, and that means that you leave your Labour Party behind, you become neutral, impartial, you preside over proceedings, and it's a very elevated position. Not only do I welcome representatives, I have to have, like, for example, I have an audience with the Queen every year in which I tell her what's going on in politics and so on. So it's quite a different role. It's not like just being an MSP.
That's fascinating and interesting. You said a lot of really interesting things in there, right? Like, in terms of the new institution in an old democracy, how do you rate what is happening, or how the Scottish Parliament is performing right now? Have you achieved or, you know, have you delivered on that promise of consensual, impactful politics for the people of Scotland?
Well, we have definitely delivered in lots of ways, but not in others. I remember very early on when I was elected in 1999, the Parliament did little interviews with all its new MSPs and asked what your hopes would be, you know, over the time of your office and so on. And I remember very specifically saying I wanted Scotland to become a more self-confident place. Scotland has always suffered. We're a proud country, but one right next to a very large country in the shape of England. And so we're in this union, this partnership, but it was quite common in Scottish history to have what we call the cultural cringe, to sort of to be dominated or to feel overlooked or sometimes to blame all our misfortunes on others, to blame them on other people. And I wanted Scotland just to be, you know, more proud of who we were in a good way, not in a, you know, bravado or in a boastful way. And I think we have. One of the key decisions I would say is typical of this was the ban on smoking in public places. Now, America was the country that pioneered this, particularly, I think it was East and West Coast America simultaneously, banned smoking in public places. But Scotland had the worst lung cancer, the worst heart disease, the worst dental health, just poor health generally. Most of these things, they're our doings. They're our bodies, our lifestyles, and so on. But we always blamed others for our poor misfortune. And the Scottish Parliament came along, embraced this idea, as did Ireland, that we could ban smoking in public places, take control of our own health. And we did it. We did this way before the United Kingdom did, before England did. And it was a real turning point in an assertion of how you can control your own lives, make a difference for people. And Scotland over these past 22 years has become a far more progressive country, a more liberal country in lots of ways, a more open country because of the politics. And the focus of politics has very much shifted, certainly shifted away from Westminster and is half and half now between Holyrood, where the Scottish Parliament is, and Westminster. So these are the pluses, and there's lots more I could talk about, legislation that we put through and big changes. However, some of that early promise about the kind of Parliament this idea of a more discursive, more evidence-based, more consensual sharing power with the civic community and so on. There's been a strong, consistent, committed attempt to do it, but it's difficult because people vote down party lines. We live in a partisan culture, and particularly at different times, and this is one of them, partisan politics really raises its head and you have quite strong divisions and people become entrenched in their views. So yes, huge difference in Scotland politically, but perhaps not on those divides.
That's great. And I want to immediately come back to that partisan piece and what that means and to your observation that Labour wasn't doing so well in 2016. And so we'll get into that. But before we do, I think it's important to hear from you a little bit about the health piece, a little bit more on the health piece. I mean, you're talking about, you know, cardiovascular health and lung health and cancer. But of course, now we're all worried about public health and the pandemic. I mean, where does Scotland sit on this? I think people here in the United States know that the United States and the UK in general had a very rough time in the initial period, high infection rates. But that, you know, there might be a different story now with the vaccine rollout. Can you maybe give us a quick update on what's happening?
Sure, yeah. Things are on a different scale clearly here compared to what's happening in the States. But I'm afraid that our two countries share a similar misfortune. And I think we're probably both quite near the bottom of the league in terms of COVID infection rates per 100,000 or per million, however you want to measure it, or death rates for that matter. And I'll be honest with you, even almost a year into this infection, I've yet to see an entirely satisfactory explanation of why we've done so badly. We went into lockdown. Now, there's arguments that we went into lockdown late. There's also arguments that despite the fact that we were, in theory, very well prepared for handling a pandemic, just like America, you know, America exports its knowledge about how to handle pandemics to all countries around the world, and Britain does the same. And yet when it happened here, we were singularly ill-prepared. We had the wrong equipment. We didn't have the test and trace mechanisms in place that we thought we did. So it's difficult to know exactly why, but we didn't do well. We didn't do well in the first wave compared to other countries. And we did spectacularly badly in the second wave compared to other countries. So I'm within the United Kingdom, you can differentiate in the sense that Scotland has done marginally better than England, but not as good as Wales and not as good as Northern Ireland. So you know, within the UK, there are nuances or slight differences. But if you take us all together, we're all in the same boat. We did really badly. And that's despite the fact that the population has been, politically, we took decisions. There was a real show of unity at the beginning. Everyone wanted to stick together, gave the executive quite a lot of authority, a lot of support. That began to fragment about halfway through a little bit, and it's been a bit more political the latter half. But certainly initially there was a real coming together, and you know the public have been huge participants, willing participants in the lockdown despite all the restrictions and the effect on the economy. But yeah, we've not. If you compare our record to many other countries, we really have not done well at all, and. I've yet to hear an explanation that properly puts its finger that quantifies it. You know, you can say yes, we were late to lockdown and we've been a bit slow. We don't have a authoritarian culture, so you know we were sort of trying to bring people with us, and almost reluctant that we didn't want to wear masks, but then we proceeded to wear masks. So you can see. Some of these things, some of them might be attitudinal or social, some of them might be political decision-making, but I've yet to see a breakdown of why it's gone so badly wrong, but it certainly is, and we're still living through it. Where the government in Scotland, and I should say this about both all the governments across Scotland, the vaccination programme is going remarkably well. So although the early stages of dealing with the pandemic wasn't good, the vaccination programme has been, I think, phenomenal. And is giving us all hope. So, and also I think a bit more, not pride is the wrong word, but you know, a bit of confidence that actually we're not totally useless at handling these situations.
Just kind of related to devolution and the value of it, is it too early to tell, or have you seen any evidence that people have changed their view on the value of devolution based on the pandemic response? I mean, what impact is it having on the population's view about the value of the Scottish Parliament?
It's very difficult to judge the impact of devolution. What you can see quite clearly is the impact of the political leadership we currently enjoy. So the Prime Minister at the moment, Boris Johnson, his personal traits, he's very likable. I'm not sure likable is the right word, but he likes to jolly people along and bring people with him. He wants to be like, he's always looking on the sunny side of things. But he's a bit vague. You know, he's not very precise in his actions or decision-making. In Scotland, the First Minister here, Nicola Sturgeon, is quite the reverse. She's very serious-minded, very cautious, very articulate and very good at explaining exactly what her actions are. So her presentation of the decisions taken in Scotland, despite the fact that the decisions are actually remarkably similar to the rest of the UK, her decisions have seen her popularity absolutely rocket. Well, she was always quite popular, but she's particularly popular now. So almost on a par, not quite on a par with Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, but who's had, you know, not just she wasn't just seen as a good communicator, she was actually seen as incredibly effective at eliminating the virus altogether. But the First Minister's contrast with the Prime Minister has been measured in the opinion polls, definitely. As for devolution, it's difficult because there was an attempt to take a sort of four nations approach, you know, England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland together approaching this as one. It didn't really last. We found quite a lot of the devolved divides creating a little bit of friction, a little bit, and it's sometimes to do with the politics of it, sometimes it's to do with one government wanting to be slightly more cautious than the other. I don't think there's any particular attempt to claim that devolution or the lack of it has been either successful in more successful in coping with this this pandemic than anything else. There has, in the sense that particularly even in England, they've ended up, they've got quite a centralized health service, and they've tried, it hasn't been working, so they've tried to devolve decision making out to their health authorities and their local councils. So in that sense, a more devolved structure has been seen as a better way of approaching things. But the devolved divide, or the political divide in Britain, has not really been a huge factor in the way we measure success in this case.
That's interesting. And it's interesting that the First Minister's popularity has increased. There's at least five questions that have come in that are going to touch on our next subjects here. And it's all about Scottish independence and sovereignty. But I mean, you already talked a little bit about the 2016 election, Labour's challenge, as a party in Scotland. In 2011, the SNP, reached its first ever majority. And then there was the referendum in 2014, which was close but not successful. Where do you see this going now? Since 2014, a lot has happened. Brexit has happened, and now the pandemic, and you're talking about the value that Nicola Sturgeon has coming out of the pandemic. I mean, what does this mean for Scottish politics between now and May, and then after May in the next election?
Well, Bob, if I could tell you the authoritative answer to that, I'd probably retire, and I'd go down the betting shop and then retire on my earnings. It's very difficult to know. The Scottish National Party and its support for independence, I think, for a long time has been around, between a third and 40%, let's say, of Scots have always had some sympathy for the idea of Scottish independence. But nationalism has not just risen in Scotland. You can see nationalism around the world. It's not a unique phenomenon. So nationalism in America, the whole success of President Trump and America First, that's a form of nationalism in all sorts of countries. In England or in the rest of the UK, but particularly in England, Brexit was essentially about English nationalism more than anything else. So we've got Scottish nationalism, English nationalism. It's all and they're all on the, or they have been on the rise over the last two decades and more. Scottish nationalism brought us to the independence referendum in 2014, and it was quite a heated. Politically contentious issue, had a huge turnout in the referendum, 85% just about, and the result was 55% no, 45% yes about leaving the United Kingdom. And it just began to recede, and then the Brexit referendum happened in 2016. And in Brexit, and as I say, Brexit's probably, I think it's probably in Scotland quite often seen through the prism of Scottish nationalism, and you can recognize the English nationalism in it. So as the whole country, the whole of Britain voted by a small majority, 52% to 48, to leave the European Union. In Scotland, the Scottish people voted quite strongly. I think it was roughly 58% to 32% to stay in the EU. So we were voting against the rest of the UK trend. And what that did was it just rocketed constitutional issues and national identity, international relations back to the top of the political agenda. And they've utterly dominated ever since, until the pandemic came along, of course. Where we go from here is very difficult to tell, because in 2014, the then UK government, the constitutional framework of the United Kingdom is a reserved matter. In other words, it is the decision can only be taken by the Westminster Parliament. It's not devolved to Scotland. So issues devolved to Scotland would include health, education, justice, and so on, and many more, lots of taxation issues and so many more. But constitutional issues, foreign affairs are reserved to Westminster. In 2014, the Westminster government agreed to hold a referendum, agreed that Scotland could organise its own referendum. Currently, Westminster is very hostile to that. They say, look, you've had a referendum. They would say that the SNP claimed it was a once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-a-generation event. So, are you just going to keep having another referendum until you win it? I mean, that's not a way to govern anything. So that's their argument. The Scottish, the supporters for independence would say, well, yes, we lost that independence referendum there, but circumstances have changed. And the biggest circumstance that changes is we've left the United, we've left the European Union. So the people of Scotland, and you can see in the opinion polls this year, opinion in Scotland has never really been in favour of independence. But since Brexit and since the pandemic, particularly since the pandemic last year, support in the opinion polls for independence has been above 50%. And it's been above 50% consistently now for certainly not quite a year, but certainly the last 20 polls in a row have all shown support for independence would be the majority position. We're heading for a clash. We've got parliamentary elections in May. The very strong leg, I mean, I can't tell you what's going to happen. The SNP are very, very much ahead in the polls. The Green Party are also supporters of independence. So it's certainly very easy to envisage a majority situation where independent supporters win the majority in the Scottish Parliament. And that will put them on a head-on collision with the UK government, because the UK government has dug its heels in and said, we're not going to hold a referendum. So then you're into the scenario of, and this is what the new, this has just come out in the last 2 weeks. The Scottish National Party have said they will now potentially organise their own referendum. Now, in the past, they've always gone away from that because they say they want to make sure that whatever decision is taken has the acceptance and the approval of all. But they're now saying, no, actually, we could probably hold our own referendum and that would have authority. So, and but it's not fully clear how that will work out, but that's the route we're on. So it looks like constitutional issues are going to dominate once more, certainly for a considerable while. And it looks like we're on a collision course over whether or not to have a referendum or whether it would be legal or not.
There's a question in on the chat here. What do you see as the prospects for the eventual in the near and or the long term of full-blown sovereignty? And it sounds like the answer to that question is it depends on the legality of the referendum. There is, I think, some precedence in Europe for this. People who are familiar with the question in Northern Ireland, of course, a referendum for a unification referendum, or the authority for a unification referendum, have to come from the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and there's a little bit of fuzziness around how that's actually determined. And of course, we saw earlier, maybe it was last year in Catalonia, with people actually being jailed after the referendum. I mean, there's an interesting question here that touches on that in the Q&A line. So do you think that there's a prospect from this listener that there could be a union of the Celts, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Ireland, Wales, Breton, Iberia, through language and culture? So I mean, that could be a political union or it could be kind of a cultural union, but do you see that as an effective kind of way for Scotland to exercise its interest in sovereignty? Or if you want to extend that question a little bit, since you're no longer part of the European Union, we can turn to this, but as maybe some kind of engagement with the council, the regions of Europe, kind of a concept. Do you think there's a possibility for Scotland to kind of do more, along with those kind of near neighbors?
Yeah. Undoubtedly is the answer, certainly along cultural, social, and hopefully economic and other lines as well. There's an awful lot, as you might imagine, here in Scotland, there's been an affinity, for example, with Ireland for many, many years. I mean, centuries, I suppose, but certainly we feel a common bond, so much shared heritage. And also, again, we feel, because we are countries on the fringe of Europe, but also with this huge dominant partner, England, sitting beside us. Our histories are slightly different. Ireland, for example, Ireland was essentially colonized at one point, whereas Scotland is an independent country that formed a partnership. So they're not quite the same, but the similarities are, and the bonds between our countries are very much there. And we have very close ties with the other devolved countries. So with Wales and Northern Ireland, we have very close relationships because we have a similar relationship with Westminster. And so we make common cause a lot. We also look to other countries like our Nordic neighbours and so on, slightly different language barriers and slightly different sets of interests. But again, we see ourselves, you know, very much we're established democracies that believe in, you know, rules-based trade, that believe in a liberal society and so on. So we have a lot in common there. So we are definitely reaching out to these countries and we are establishing links, and we are, because the world is getting smaller, well, perhaps not during the pandemic, but, you know, international travel is so easy. We have a lot of mixing with those countries. But just to bring it back to the sort of realpolitik, as it were, the actual trading relationships and the economies are the United Kingdom and the European Union. So Scotland is on the same island as England and Wales, and Northern Ireland is part of that. We all share a currency, a central bank, a tax system, a passport, you know, defence forces. But I suppose going back to the economy, the two-thirds or just under two-thirds of Scottish trade is with England. You know, that's the, or the rest of the United Kingdom, anyway, the rest of the United Kingdom. So it's difficult to see beyond that in the in terms of the strength of these other relationships. We want to we're always looking to build stronger relationships. The Scottish government and the Irish government, for example, have developed a very good relationship recently and established a partnership agreement on which to take forward a lot of these initiatives. This is particularly around the cultural, the social, the parliamentary and others. But and I think everybody would like to see greater economic relationships, but just the realpolitik is that England's the biggest country by miles, by a factor of 10, essentially. And so much trade goes back and forward there. It's the dominant partner. The EU beyond that, I mean, interesting, America is actually our single biggest country that we trade with, apart from within the UK. But if you take the EU as a block, they are then the next biggest after the UK. So then it's the EU and then America. And so these are existing trade blocks with their existing systems. And although we are trying to form relationships with these other countries, they are very much in their infancy compared to these established relationships.
It's interesting you're talking about Scotland's trading relationship with the European Union. And obviously, we've been hearing a lot about Northern Irish Protocol here, Article 16, the vaccine issue that the Commission kind of stoked up a little bit. But even before that, there were tensions developing in that protocol issue. How about in Scotland? I've been reading certainly here in the States, the newspapers have been covering some of the challenges of getting Scottish seafood to market in the European Union, for instance. I mean, where are the biggest pressure points for Scotland right now in the trade relationship with the European Union?
Well, you put your finger right on them. Fishing is the biggest. If you think about Britain as an island and therefore one that's got quite a relatively big fishing industry, and I say relatively big because it's still tiny. I think the fishing industry is like 1% of the whole country's GDP. But even that, it's got more resonance than that, than perhaps its economic clout. But off that fishing industry, the vast majority of the fishing industry is located in Scotland. And so it has, it's got a huge cultural and national significance in Scotland, and it has been badly damaged. The whole point of leaving the EU was it's supposed to actually take us out of the common fisheries policy and give us more freedom. But the process of leaving the EU has been tricky. And so the process of leaving the common fisheries policy has been staggered over 5 years. And in the immediate aftermath, with the immediate bureaucratic difficulties, there's been all sorts of problems come up. And so the fishing leaders have been expressing their outrage. There's also a few other small agriculture. I mean, the main decisions taken in Europe were about fishing and agriculture. Lots of other economic decisions were taken here. So fishing and agriculture have been the two difficult areas because that commonality has gone. And so we have things like seed potatoes, which are a big industry in Scotland. A tiny industry, but big in Scotland, if you know what I mean. They've been disrupted. Lamb, again, has the huge cost going up there. So there's lots of issues around there, which are coming out, and they are coming out in political debate. it's still early days. It's very difficult to tell what's happening because there's still a willingness, as you might imagine, to try and keep all these avenues of trade open. And the pandemic's made things even more difficult to work out what is going on. So we know there's been disruption. We know that Scottish fishermen and Scottish farmers have suffered, but we don't yet know whether that's a short-term effect of the leaving or is going to be a long-term, or how serious the long-term damaging effects will be. And that's the situation we're in at the moment.
There's an interesting question that's come in that touches on something that's near to this, and it's about the impact on Scottish universities, from the Brexit fallout. There's obviously a lot of pride in the Scottish educational system. I went to, I did one of my degrees at McGill, which is a Scottish Enlightenment University in Montreal. I didn't really know much about it, the Scottish Enlightenment, until actually went to Canada and learned about the serious impact. I should have known more. It's kind of embarrassing that I didn't. It's quite an important, I played quite an important role in intellectual history. What do you see as the consequences for universities now? Ireland, for instance, has, put a floor under the Erasmus program for students in Northern Ireland. How about Scotland? How are they going to interact? Is there a challenge to their research budgets? I mean, what is happening in Scottish universities right now?
Yeah, it's another very difficult, very sensitive issue, which we're not quite sure how we're going to come out the other side of it yet. So this has happened in the middle of an academic year. So in the middle of this pandemic, we've left the European Union. One of the key decisions there was to leave Erasmus. The Erasmus, for those who don't know, is essentially the scholarship exchange student by which students from all around the European Union can travel freely and go to different institutions. And it's been a phenomenal, successful program. So that's ended. Now, the UK government have ended it. I don't want to put words in the mouth, but I think they've ended it because what they don't want is arguments being made for the European Union by the back door, as it were. But what they're saying is they're going to end that system but replace it with another one that's almost identical. So that's what they want to do. That's easier said than done, as you might imagine. But that's what they're trying. And of course, the universities who all rely on this interchange these days, you'll know yourself, universities are so international, much more than they ever were. I mean, when I was at Edinburgh University and I had an exchange with the University of Pennsylvania, I absolutely loved every minute. It was so good. And these sort of exchanges that we have are liberating, but they're happening more than ever. And you'll know at Boston College how important it is to get your students to come and do exchanges here. So anything that gets in that way is really debilitating. So the universities here are looking to try and work with the UK government and the Scottish government, either to create maybe a backdoor into Erasmus or another way of Scotland having a part of Erasmus, which the Scottish government is definitely looking at. But may or may not be able to pull off. The UK government is looking at an alternative to Erasmus. So I think these are the two avenues. I think both value the exchange. From a cultural point of view, even from an earnings point of view, Scotland and the rest of the UK are net exporters of education. In other words, lots of students come here to learn. The universities are represented in different countries around the world. Education is seen as a real asset. I think we educate way more than our own population. So lots of people come here to study medicine or whatever else. So people want to continue that, but it's definitely under threat at the moment. And the way out is not 100% clear.
Kind of as a continuation of that and the EU's contribution to what was happening in Scotland, obviously, the EU contributed, a lot in the common agricultural program, the structural funds, the competitive funds from the EU Commission. We've heard from Diane Dodds, she's the Minister for the Economy in the Northern Ireland Assembly, talking about trying to make up that shortfall with a disbursement from Westminster and having some difficulty in doing it. I mean, where is Scotland in trying to fill just that pure resource, that financial resource that the EU played, in Scotland's life?
Yes, again, this is such a sensitive political issue, Bob, at the moment. So you're absolutely right in identifying these funds as crucial to, particular to parts of the economy. It would be unfair to say it's across the whole Scottish economy, but certain parts, and particular the rural parts of Scotland, so the Highlands and Islands, and also some of the more deprived communities. If you look at Scotland as a whole, Scotland's a pretty wealthy country, and Scotland and the UK were net contributors to the EU. So the EU, you know, at that point, 28 countries, Britain was putting in a lot more money than we were getting out, if you know what I mean. So so in theory, if we're no longer members, then Britain should have more. We're not giving it to Europe anymore, so we should be able to disperse that money, in fact, more. There'll be a new mechanism by which that happens. The Westminster government have talked about it. This is where it gets very political. They're setting up a fund to do this. In theory, they should give the money to the Scottish Parliament, because health, welfare, social improvement schemes, they tend to be all devolved. But they don't want to, the Conservative government at Westminster don't particularly want to give the SNP more government here, more resources. So they're setting up a UK fund so that it gets dispersed from Westminster. So it gets very, very political at the moment. It's still, we're still only, you know, 2 months into having left the European Union. What happened was that everybody agreed to maintain the current sort of state of affairs as much as possible. So what will happen is that as they come up for renewal, replacements will have to be found. And each one of them is happening almost as we speak. That we had an announcement last week about a tourism fund. We've had announcements about support for hill farmers. So they're being developed. The chances are the funds will get there eventually, but it's not clear yet how. And as you imagine, there's always going to be winners and losers in that situation. And that always makes for interesting politics, if we can put it that way.
We'll have to stay tuned. It certainly is quite interesting. There are three, speaking of interesting questions that have come in around that touch on these issues and Scottish political identity and leadership. One question that's come in is, do you think that the leadership void in the Scottish Labour and Conservative parties will affect the May election? This person has done their research. They know that the Scottish leadership election gives the winner only about 8 weeks to make their mark before the ballot in May. I mean, what's your take on that?
I don't think it'll do them any good. So at the moment, the Conservative Party do have a leader, but it's quite complicated. Their leader, Douglas Ross, is not represented in the Scottish Parliament. So Ruth Davidson is their leader in the Scottish Parliament, and she's stepping down. Scottish Labour have a leadership contest yet again, and that'll be decided at the end of the month. So yeah, I mean, I don't think it's I don't think these sort of things can really help a party, I would imagine, going into an election. At the same time, if you had an unpopular leader before, or a leader who wasn't helping you get votes, then, you know, having a contest isn't necessarily a bad thing either. So it could be that it's not necessarily any worse than it would have been. There are a lot of big factors happening. There's a lot of politics happening at the moment in Scotland. There's a very, very big battle being played out between the current First Minister and leader of the SNP, Nicola Sturgeon, and the former First Minister and former leader of the SNP, Alex Salmond. So the two of them used to be extremely close. I mean, she was his protege. And they're now at war in the courts and in the parliament. And it's quite nasty. And that's playing out at the moment. The Scottish Labour leader is having an election. And we've got a Conservative Party being led by somebody who's out with the parliament itself. I'll be honest with you, these factors are really seen as, none of them are figuring as highly in people's voting intentions as the pandemic, the future state of the economy, public services, our approach to the health service, and so on. So they're of a lesser order in terms of the way they'll shape the outcome. But, you know, sometimes it's around these margins that are really important. So the SNP would very, very much like to win an outright majority in the Scottish Parliament, which it's done once before, and could, the opinion polls suggest they could do it again. However, if they don't, That's got quite a lot of ramifications in the way, well, all sorts of decisions are taken. You know, when you have to work with other partners, it produces a different style of politics. So these little margins can matter.
So in the run-up to that election, what do you expect Nicola Sturgeon's strategy will be? And there's a couple of questions that touch on it here. You know, how much of this is going to be about, you know, the contest between Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, or between Sturgeon and Boris Johnson? And how much of this will be about the sovereignty issue, the border issue? And if it is, you know, is there an opportunity for other parties like Labour to kind of reassert themselves in the ballot, do you think?
I'll try and give you an overview of this. I can't tell you what each of the party's strategies would be, but I can tell you the sort of comments that get made in the paper and so on that I hope reflect that. So this SNP, the Scottish National Party, particularly the First Minister, she is focused on the pandemic first and foremost. And it's because it's the dominant issue, she's very single-minded and also running it very, not single-handed, that's unfair, but she's utterly dominant. She does a daily press conference on the figures and how she's handling it, the decision she's taken and so on. And without being unkind, because I don't mean this in a nasty way, that's also playing very well politically. And I'm not saying that's why she's doing it, but it just is. It works out very well for her. Within her party, though, they know that the supporters of independence know they're potentially on the brink of independence. And so there's some who are really pushing hard for independence. Now, the difficulty is, and what people like Nicola Sturgeon don't know, is if they promote independence up their political priority list, which they have done and are likely to continue to do in the election, that might not play well with the public, because the public might think, we don't want to talk about independence, we want you to talk about the pandemic. So they've got a tricky balance there, a very tricky balance. The Conservative Party, and she would love the election to be about a choice between her and Boris Johnson, because Boris Johnson is very unpopular in Scotland and she is very popular. So she would absolutely love it. And so the SNP, if that was the way it was portrayed. The Conservatives, they are actually, although they don't want it to be necessarily about Boris Johnson, they quite like it being about independence, because they see themselves as the party of the union. So they're the Conservative and Unionist party. So they think this is, that's how they got their upsurge at the last election. They think they'll do well if they fight it on the grounds of independence, that we'll stop the breakup of the United Kingdom. The Labour Party don't win on that ground. They can't win a vote, because they're against independence, but it's not a priority for them. Nobody's going to vote for them either way, because if you're talking about is independence, you're either voting for an independence party or a non-independence party, and a party which is against independence but doesn't really see it as a priority is squeezed out. So they want to change the argument to talk about, you know, poverty, equality, the economy, the future kind of society we have, and so on, but they're getting squeezed out. So that's roughly where the battle lines are being drawn. It's going to be very interesting. Apart from anything else, the normal rules, we normally have a 6-week dissolution period where Parliament stops, all government activity or public government activity stops, and you talk and go campaigning. No one's allowed to go out knocking on doorsteps or talking to voters. The government will have to continue because it's handling the pandemic. So this might be an entirely sort of social media debate. It's difficult to know. So it's very, very unusual territory indeed.
It's interesting stuff. We only have a few minutes left, and so I'm going to switch gears in a way that maybe grinds them a little bit quickly. But this year, with Biden's election, there's been a change of some policies in the U.S. and climate change has been pushed to the forefront of much of U.S. policy. John Kerry will be elevated into the role of climate czar, essentially at the cabinet level. But even other secretaries in Biden's cabinet have been really concerned about this. Mayor Marty Walsh, who will become Secretary for Labor, Pete Buttigieg in transport. And of course, this is really relevant to what's happening right now in Scotland. You're preparing for the COP26, the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. So I just, maybe if you could give people an update on how preparation for that summit is going, and then maybe you could just reflect on, what does that mean for Scotland's international connections And you know, to the United States and Europe around using that issue to develop bigger relationships.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's the COP26 was supposed to happen last year in Glasgow and was cancelled because of the pandemic, but it's programmed again for this year. And it's seen as a huge opportunity, and it already has rejuvenated the discussion on environmental issues here in Scotland, as well as across the UK, but particularly here in Scotland. So in Scotland, I'll be honest with you, our record on the environment is mixed. We have oil off our coast, an oil and gas industry, which is pretty, it's a pretty important industry to Scotland. And our history is based on heavy industry, on shipbuilding and car manufacturing, coal mining, steel making, and so on. So we come from a very, not particularly environmentally friendly economy and so on. And, but like every other country, just like as in America, environmental issues have, you know, thrust themselves upon us. And we're absolutely, just as you are, very much aware of global climate change and the threat to everybody's environment. It's now figuring very, very prominently on election manifestos, because particularly for young voters, it's actually a decisive vote. It's a lot of young people are coming into politics because of the environment. In the past, you know, it'd be a very, very small fringe that would be motivated by these issues, whereas now, quite the reverse. It's a huge issue for young people. So all the political parties have stopped paying lip service to environmental issues and are now really pushing it hard. And yes, we've set very strict targets, and at the moment it's very much what we're going to do in the future rather than what we're doing right here and now, because these are quite tricky issues, but we are wrestling with them. I think the COP26 can only multiply that, because Scotland would love to be, for example, moving away from an oil-based economy to solar or wind-powered, more than solar-powered here, but and we have a huge wind industry. So we'd like to take advantage of that. We've just had announcements on the hydrogen economy and so on. So there's lots of opportunities that we think that we could shift our economy and, as you see, reach out to others. It was difficult to describe how relieved an awful lot of people were that President Biden won because of the environment. I mean, it's if you ignore everything else that's going on, it was quite worrying, because America is such a dominant power generally, you know, not just democratically, but just in terms of the way that it shapes the economy, that to have a global leadership on this issue, it was really, really quite important. So for lots of reasons, yes, there's actually a wave of optimism about what might happen, and it's very much in the might happen at this stage, and also whether or not we can take advantage of it. Well, our record isn't that great. As I say, we've covered our country with wind turbines, but they're all made in Germany, so you know it's that's not necessarily been, you know, leading the way in the green revolution. But yeah,
there's certainly a lot of wind. My first trip to Scotland was at Fringe Festival, and I think it was the coldest August I've ever experienced in my life. I think I had to go out and buy a jacket. We're just about out of time. I'd want to wrap up with one final question from the audience, and I'm sorry if I didn't get to your questions. There's a few more hanging out there, but we got through a good fair bit of them. There's one person listening here. Would like to know, and I think given, you know, what transpired in the Six Nations over the weekend, it's a good question. They'd like to know if rugby will ever be transported to the United States, or do you think, you know, American football is just too strong?
Yeah, it's never going to happen, is it? Yeah, I think there's more chance of American football catching on here. We've had lots of experiments with it. I used to go watch it in London, and I think there's more chance of somebody in Britain buying a franchise and getting one of the big American teams to come over here. That because there's a big appetite. There was a lot of people here up, as you can imagine. It started at 1 a.m, but they were up watching the Super Bowl. I think rugby is very much, although we're very proud, and we as you might imagine, we beat England in our opening game. We are so excited. exciting this year, you know, at our prospects. It's a game played by quite a few, quite a small number, I should say, of countries. What's more interesting, though, is that soccer, that football soccer, is now such a huge sport in America. And I think that's, you know, because rugby is a big sport. Soccer is the biggest sport by far in Britain, by far, particularly in Scotland, in the west of Scotland. It's absolutely dominates. It's the biggest sport by miles. I think mainly because you can play it in the cold and the rain, which is our natural environment.
Well, thank you very much, Presiding Officer. We've used about an hour of your time, so I want to thank you for joining with us. It was very illuminating. I certainly have a lot more questions about Scottish political identity and economic ties and your relationships with the European Union post-Brexit. But we're going to have to leave that until you come to Boston College in person. And the invitation is definitely there for you to join us. And hopefully on one of your trips to the United States, you'll be able to come and meet with us here. I want to thank your team for setting this up. This was all born out of a relationship that developed around your team hosting our undergraduates on a study abroad program, and then which they found phenomenal, and their time in Edinburgh was outstanding. So thank you for hosting them and continuing to be willing to host. I'd also like to thank all the people who joined us today for taking the time to hear this conversation, and thank you for your questions. Hope you can join us again for our next event on February 24th. We'll have the president of Queen's University Belfast and our Northern Ireland at Boston College leadership series. Finally, I'd like to thank Ellen Wong for joining us and putting the US-Scottish relationship in context and frame. Thank you, Presiding Officer. I appreciate your time.
Bob, thank you. And thanks to all your audience. Can I just say you'd be very welcome indeed if you bring any students over here. Very welcome indeed.
Excellent. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today as we work to enhance Boston College's presence and impact in the world by building trust, community, and dialogue. Please visit our website at bc.edu for more information on today's speaker and follow us on Twitter at GLIATBC, or find us on LinkedIn at Global Leadership Institute at Boston College.